So welcome to Strong Gravity. So in this class, we're going to study black holes, gravitational waves, and other aspects of dynamical space-time. So just a couple words on logistics. So we're going to have lectures here normally Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, but this week actually we'll have a lecture on Friday to give you Monday free to watch the eclipse. And then we'll have tutorials on Tuesday afternoon starting today. So the first tutorial we'll be on exploring geodesics on Kerr spacetime. So there'll be six tutorials, and some of them will involve some sort of low-key numerics in the sense of integrating ordinary differential equations for which you can use Mathematica or Python or Maple or whatever your favorite mathematical program is. So hopefully everyone knows how to do that. If not, at the beginning of the tutorial, there'll be some introduction on how to integrate ODEs. So for the lectures, you know, we have a small class, so please feel free to interrupt with questions or tell me when I make a mistake on the board. Also, I'm happy to stick around afterwards and answer any questions people have after lectures or if they want to, go on in any tangents. Yeah, and so the TA for this class is Tal Shimei, and the teaching faculty is Ghazal. Yep. One thing that I'm going to sort of emphasize in this course is that, with the detections by gravitational wave detectors like LIGO and Virgo of gravitational waves from merging black holes and neutron stars, now, we've really entered this age where we're able to observe the dynamics of space-time. And so the sort of overarching theme of this course will be to introduce some of the concepts and theoretical tools that will actually allow us to think of Einstein's equations as evolution equations that tell us what happens dynamically. We can start with some initial conditions, and the theory will tell us what happens. And we'll study things like how to define black hole space-times and dynamical settings, how gravitational waves are generated, and things like that. So we'll start out a bit slowly at the beginning of the course, mainly focusing on Kerr spacetime and its properties and what happens on the background of Kerr spacetime. But then we'll move on to how to formulate Einstein's equations as a set of evolution equations and what the initial value problem looks like in Einstein's theory of general relativity. And then we'll, in the last part, move on to gravitational waves, how to define energy and angular momentum, how they're generated, and so on. So any questions so far? So I assume everyone here has already taken the introductory GR course. So I'm just going to give a very lightning review of basic GR just to fix some conventions. All right, so first, now that we're all advanced relativists, we're going to use geometric units, where we set Newton's gravitational constant g and the speed of light both to 1 to make our equation simpler. For indexing tensors, I'm going to use the following conventions. So Roman letters like A, B, C, so on, I'll use to index 4 variables. That's space plus time. And I'll use the later letters, the alphabet I, J, K, and so on, just to refer to purely spatial vectors or spatial components. So for example, for a vector, this would be ut, and then the three spatial vectors would be ui, the three spatial components. All For our metric signature, we're going to use the East Coast metric, also known as the mostly plus metric because of its obvious superiority. And so our metric allows us to measure distances. So the proper length squared is given, is related to the space-time metric G in this way. And so this allows us to calculate distances, space-time distances on our manifold. And in terms of this metric, we can define associated connection, the Christoffel symbols. And we notice that this is symmetric in the AB indices, which is how you can check that you've written it down correctly. So if we switch A and B, these two switch, and this one stays the same. So once we have the Christoffel symbols, we can use those to define our covariant derivatives. So if we apply a covariant derivative to a general tensor with upper and lower indices, then we get the partial derivative of that tensor. And then we have to use our Christoffel symbols and contract those with all the upper and lower indices. So we get a plus sign for the upper ones. And so then we do that for all the upper indices, and then we get a minus sign when we contract with the lower ones. And then we have to do that for all the lower indices as well. And we've chosen this covariant derivative such that it's so-called metric compatible. And that just means even though the partial derivative of our metric is not necessarily zero, the covariant derivative is zero. And now that we have these covariant derivatives, so partial derivatives commute, but covariant derivatives in general do not on a curved space-time manifold. So if we want to measure how much these covariant derivatives fail to commute, when we apply them to some vector, that defines our Riemann tensor. And so if we work through what this definition implies about the Riemann tensor and write it in terms of derivatives of these Christoffel symbols, we get something like the following. So we notice that we have first derivatives of the Christoffel symbols, which themselves involve first derivatives of the metric. So this Riemann tensor is defined in terms of second derivatives of the metric. So now that we have this Riemann tensor, we can use that. We can contract it to define several other quantities. So we have the Ricci tensor. Which we get just by contracting these two indices. And then we have the Ricci scalar, which we just get by contracting the remaining indices. And then finally, we can use that to define the Einstein tensor. That's the Ricci tensor minus 1/2 the Ricci scalar times the metric. And now we have sort of everything we need to write down Einstein's equations. Which is just that the Einstein tensor is equal to 8 pi times the stress energy tensor. So this basically, this left-hand side more or less encodes the curvature of space-time, and the right-hand side encodes the matter content. So we should note that if you don't impose any conditions on this stress energy tensor, then the Einstein equations don't really impose any conditions on your manifold, right? You could always write down an arbitrary manifold you want, just calculate its Einstein tensor, divide by 8 pi, and if you call that the matter, then that is quote-unquote a solution to the Einstein equations. But normally we're interested in matter that satisfies certain conditions. First of all, we immediately from this relation, we can see that the stress energy tensor has to be conserved. That is, when we apply the covariant derivative, we have to get zero. So does anyone remember why that has to follow?
Bianchi
identity, that's right. So the Bianchi identity tells us, in general, just a mathematical identity that if we take the Einstein tensor and take the covariant derivative, it should be zero. So if we apply it to the left-hand side, then we get zero, so we better get it for the right-hand side too. So we're not going to be dealing with matter a whole lot in this class, but as an example of a stress energy tensor, sort of the canonical example, we can write down the one for a perfect fluid. So that's given by the following expression. So here, rho is the energy density in the fluid frame, P is the pressure, U is the forward velocity of the fluid, and again, this is the pressure. So usually, we want to impose some conditions on the stress energy tensor in order to actually also have some conditions on the space-time manifolds we can consider that are solutions to the Einstein equation. So there are a lot of different energy conditions which are more or less motivated. But just as an example of one, I can write down the null energy condition. which requires that if I consider any null vector ka that's future pointing, and I contract it with my stress energy tensor, then this should be greater than or equal to zero. So if I apply this to the stress energy tensor, you can see that I get since by definition null vector when contracted with a metric will just give you zero. So since this has to be greater than or equal to zero, just by construction, we're basically, this null energy condition only requires that the energy density plus the pressure be greater than or equal to zero. So it's a rather mild condition that we'll use later in the class. It's actually, in fact, weaker than the so-called weak energy condition. Okay, so that sort of is our lightning review of introductory GR. Is there any questions before we move on to Kerr black holes? Okay, so for the next couple lectures, we're going to focus on the Kerr solution, which describes an isolated rotating black hole. And the dynamics that can sort of happen on the background of Kerr spacetime. So, you know, the first question you might have is, you know, why is Kerr so special? Why are we spending so much time studying it? And so to answer this question, I'd like to read this quote from Chandrasekhar, who was one of the pioneers of relativity. So his quote goes, "In my entire scientific life, extending over 45 years, the most shattering experience has been the realization that an exact solution of Einstein's equations of general relativity, discovered by the New Zealand mathematician Roy Kerr, provides the absolute exact representation of untold numbers of massive black holes that populate the universe." So let's try to unpack that statement and say what Chandrasekhar meant by that. So it turns out that the Kerr solution sort of satisfies a number of properties that we'll try to go through in the course of this class. One property is it is actually the only possible stationary vacuum solution to the Einstein equations. So we're not going to prove the statement, but this is actually sort of proved in the late 60s and 70s by some pioneering work of Israel, Carter, Hawking, and Robinson. So Kerr black holes are sort of the unique stationary vacuum black hole solution. Another important property of Kerr that we'll get to sort of in the last part of this class is that perturbations of Kerr actually decay very rapidly on sort of light crossing times of the black hole. So we'll get to this later when we discuss what are called quasi-normal modes, which describe perturbations of black holes. And the final property is that Kerr black holes are at least conjectured to be the final state of generic collapse. That is, if you take some arbitrary matter distribution that's going to collapse, eventually you'll get a Kerr black hole. It will be characterized by its mass and angular momentum, plus some gravitational waves, which will radiate to infinity. And so this is sort of the what's sometimes referred to as the no hair property of black holes. So, you know, in addition to mass and angular momentum, we could also consider electromagnetic charge for a black hole. But we're going to sort of ignore that in this class, and in part because that's generally thought to not be astrophysically relevant. Any small charge at a black hole that we try to accumulate would sort of be discharged by preferentially absorbing charges of the opposite sign. So let's write down the Kerr solution in what are called Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. Can you see that from back there? Okay. All right, so that's the Kerr metric and Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. We have R is the radial coordinate, theta is this polar angle, phi is the azimuthal angle, and then t is time. And now I need to define a couple of things. So the sigma is given by this, r squared plus a squared cosine squared theta, and then I also introduce this delta, and then this A parameter is going to turn out to be equal to the total angular momentum of our spacetime divided by the mass of our spacetime. And sometimes we'll find it convenient to define a dimensionless parameter, which is just taking this and dividing by another power of m, so we get a dimensionless number. So I'm going to call that a bar. Sometimes people call that chi, or sometimes I also just call it a. But in for our uses, this will be dimensionless, and this is a lot of the same dimensions as mass. All right, so let's begin by looking at this metric in a couple different limits. So the first one is just if we set A to 0, then what do we get? Schwarzschild, yeah. We just get a non-spinning black hole with no angular momentum. You can check this becomes spherically symmetric.
Construct the dimensions to restore the G, because I don't have really the intuition. Like, where would I put them? Yeah.
I think basically where the M's are, you want to put the G's.
It's always good. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, basically you want to have like the G and the times M over R within the dimensionless, yeah.
So there are no like exceptions to that rule.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, any other questions? All right, so another limit we can consider is what happens if we fix the dimensionless spin, but then let the mass go to zero. So if we let the mass go to zero, what do you think we should get? Does anybody know space-time with no mass?
Flat space-time?
Yeah, Minkowski, flat space-time. Yeah, so if we write down what that is, I write that down, it doesn't really look like Minkowski, or it's not immediately obvious that it is. So to sort of get it to the more familiar Cartesian form, you actually need a coordinate transformation. And that's given by the following. So you can see these kind of, so you can check that if you do this coordinate transformation, you just get Minkowski back in the usual Cartesian coordinates. But so the coordinates that we have for the Boyle-Lindquist are kind of these ellipsoidal coordinates. So you can see that this, like one particular thing to note is that if we consider r equals zero, then we have z equals zero, but we don't have x and y equals zero. We actually, get this basically ring in the equatorial plane, the z equals zero plane, where x squared plus y squared equals a squared, right? That's an important thing to keep in mind, is that basically these coordinates don't necessarily, even in flat space, cover the whole domain. So next up, I want to talk about the symmetries of Kerr. So to discuss symmetries, let's begin by recalling the definition of a killing vector. So we say that some vector k is killing. If when we take the lead derivative with respect to k of the metric, then we get zero. So hopefully you've seen this before, or if not, we can write down the general definition of the lead derivative, which is in terms of partial derivatives. Given by this expression, and we can also actually have the exact same expression where we just replace all these partial derivatives with the covariate derivatives. So, you know, in general, we can't make this replacement, but you can check that basically the extra terms are all going to cancel out between these three terms by symmetry. So if we write it this way, and now we're, you know, thinking about the metric, this first term is just going to be, when we replace it with a partial covariant derivative, it's going to be what we apply to the metric?
Zero.
And then we have just this one, and this one. So we can also just write that slightly more compactly this way, where this is the symmetric combination, and the factor of two is just to cancel out the one half in this definition. So, so from this definition here, we can note that basically, if our metric is independent of some coordinate, like if all the metric coefficients in some particular coordinates are don't depend on that coordinate, then we can immediately define a killing vector in terms of that coordinate. So, you know, if we look at this this metric here, we can notice that none of the metric coefficients depend on time or the azimuthal direction. And that means that basically just by using this expression, that if we define a killing vector that's just has a component, the only non-zero component is in that particular coordinate component, then we get a killing vector. So the killing vectors of Kerr are one is the killing vector that just has the component in the azimuthal direction. I'm going to call it phi hat. And so that's associated with the axis symmetry of our spacetime. And the other one, I'm going to call it t hat, is our vector that becomes time-like at spatial infinity. And that's associated with the fact that our spacetime is stationary.
Meant that this vector is time-like at spatial infinity.
Yeah, so this is the vector that's just has a 1 and a time component 0 otherwise. And, you know, at spatial infinity, that's just going the time direction. But we'll get to later what this vector does near the black hole. Yeah, and so just a side note, you know, Kerr is stationary, but it's actually not static. And so what that means that if it's not static if A is not equal to zero. And that's because if we let T go to minus T, we don't get the same solution. In particular, you can see that this dt d phi term spoils that. Now let T go to minus T. So yeah, if like me, you sometimes have trouble remembering what's the difference between static and stationary, you think of a stationary exercise bike. You know, it's not going anywhere, but it's spinning the same way at all times, just like the Kerr black hole. Whereas if you had a static exercise bike, you wouldn't really burn any calories. Yeah, and so as a side note, we can say that in addition to these two killing vectors of Kerr, there's actually also a non-trivial killing tensor. So by a killing tensor, I just mean sort of generalizing this definition that this equals zero to a tensor with two components. So can anyone quickly think of a maybe somewhat trivial example of a killing tensor?
The metric.
Yeah, the metric itself. Just by a metric compatibility. But actually, Kerr has another one, which is called, I believe, the Carter tensor. It's defined this way in terms of these two null vectors, L and N. So we're not going to use that much in this class. So I'm not going to bother to write out the definitions of these. But basically, it satisfies this condition, and it'll actually define a new constant that will be conserved along geodesics. And it would be important, if you consider non-equatorial geodesics in the Kerr space then. I'll say a little bit more about that later. So now we're going to talk about the horizons in Kerr. So first, if we just look at our metric here, we can notice basically two places where these expressions are not going to be well-defined. So that means our coordinates break down at two places where basically the denominator becomes zero, so that's when the sigma is equal to zero, and when this delta is equal to zero. So it turns out this sigma equals to zero actually defines a legitimate curvature singularity, in much the same way that you have a curvature singularity at r equals zero for Schwarzschild. So you can check that. For example, if you look at the Kretschmann scalar, that's just the Riemann tensor contracted with itself, it actually blows up at sigma equals to zero. But slightly different from Schwarzschild, we can notice that sigma equals to zero isn't the same as or exactly the same as r equals zero. So sigma equals zero implies that r squared plus a squared cosine squared theta equals zero. So that means we both want r equals zero and basically need to be in the equator where theta equals pi over 2. So again, that might be slightly confusing that you know, r equals zero isn't actually a point. But if we recall these, recall that we're actually in these ellipsoidal coordinates, maybe it makes a little bit more sense. And one actually can generalize this type of transformation to the Kerr spacetime, in which case one gets something called the Kerr-Shield coordinates. So basically, we have a singularity on this ring of length A that's in the equator. So that's sigma equals zero, but actually at even larger radii than we get sigma equals zero, we get delta equals zero. So to gain some insight into sort of the properties of these r equals constant surfaces, let's sort of calculate the character of them. So if we have a surface where r is some constant, and we want to determine whether that's like a space-like surface or a time-like surface or a null surface, basically want to look at the normal to that surface of constant r and see, you know, what's, if it's, when we contract it with itself, it's, if it's positive, negative, or zero. So, you know, this actually just gives us GRR with upper indices, which is equal to delta over sigma. And so you know, a very large radii, you know, can check that this is just one, that the R constant surfaces are space-like as we expect them to be. But that actually changes as you get close to the black hole. So in particular, we can check where this quantity becomes zero. So if this quantity is zero, then the r equals constant slice will be what?
Null.
It'll be null, that's right. So basically, we're interested in the zeros of delta. We can see that delta is actually just a quadratic in R, so we'll have two roots. We can write it, can factorize it into those two roots and call basically the bigger one R plus, the smaller one R minus. And just from that expression, they're given by the following. So it's going to turn out that these actually define the outer, that's the plus, and the inner horizons of the black hole. So yeah, basically a very large r, this is space-like, these r equals constant surfaces, they become null at r equals plus, then they become time-like between r plus and r minus, and then they can switch again at r minus. And actually turns out that r plus actually defines the event horizon of the black hole. That's the boundary between so the sort of the causal past of future null infinity. Yeah, so we should note that, you know, we said that our coordinates actually break down at r plus. So that's actually just the coordinate singularity, just in the same way that in Schwarzschild coordinates, they break down on the horizon. And it's possible to choose different coordinates where there's basically no problems at the horizon. The coordinates are well-defined, and there's no curvature singularities. And the Kerr-Shield solution that I mentioned before is one example of that. You also work through another example of one called harmonic coordinates in, I believe, the first homework. So one thing to note is that if we consider dimensionless spins that have magnitude greater than one, then actually we don't get any horizons, because we don't have a real solution to this. But we still have this curvature singularity at sigma equals zero. So that actually defines what's called a naked singularity, in the sense that it's a singularity with no horizon protecting it from observers far away. So for that, this is a Kerr black hole with this dimensionless spin parameter greater than one is called a super extremal black hole. And you know, we don't think they exist in nature. And in fact, we'll see some examples in class of sort of how black holes resist being spun up to super extremal values. And in general, there's a statement that all curvature singularities generic curvature singularities in GR should be hidden from faraway observers by horizons. And that concept goes by the name of the cosmic censorship conjecture. It's due to Roger Penrose. Yeah, so we're ready to sort of draw a conformal diagram of our Kerr solution. So just to recall, so for conformal diagrams, the convention is basically lines at 45 degrees correspond to null rays. So light moves at 45 degrees. That means any line like this would be space-like. Any line like this would be feature time-like. This would be past time-like. And these are null. So in this diagram, we have past null infinity, sometimes with people call it scry minus. Then we have future null infinity. So all the gravitation waves and light that goes to the asymptotically flat part. And then this boundary of all the light rays that escape to future null infinity is our outer horizon, R plus. And then inside we have this inner horizon, R minus, and then inside that we have this ring singularity, So as we noticed, you know, here I'm suppressing all the angular degrees of freedom, and we noted that this you only hit this ring singularity at, basically if you're in the equator. So basically, yeah, and you know this. The solution can be just like Schwarzschild, you know, extended with, you know, sort of infinitely many copies and the sort of maximal extension. But basically, we're going to concern ourselves with the exterior of the spacetime. And in fact, there's no good reason to believe that basically anything past R minus is physically meaningful for the Kerr solution. So there's a couple things you can note about that. So you know, basically, you know, if you consider some observer that's approaching R minus here, and you consider basically all the light rays that are going to fall into the black hole through the whole history of time, you can see that, you know, as you pass through R minus, basically all those light rays are going to hit this observer. And so in some sense, you're going to have, and there's a basically going to be an instability associated with this called the blue shift instability, where basically you're going to, small perturbations here will get, longer wavelength light here will correspond to very short wavelength here, because you basically, you know, all the these rays hit this observer in some finite time. So for that reason, it's actually expected this inner horizon will be unstable. One can also notice that this is a Cauchy horizon in the sense that, you know, if I have an observer here, basically, in the past, this is, so if I sort of imagine, you know, specifying some initial conditions here, and then when I want to propagate that forward, those will sort of uniquely determine, you know, what happens to some later point here or here. But once I pass here, I can not only receive signals from this exterior region, but also from this this interior region as well. So in some sense, you have to specify more in, information to determine what happens once you pass this Cauchy horizon. Yeah, so that's slightly confusing, but any questions about that? Okay. So the next concept I want to discuss is the ergosphere. So let's consider our Killing vector associated with stationarity, and let's basically calculate what we get when we contract it with itself to see what its character is. So can anyone tell me what metric component that's going to be equal to?
GTT,
that's right. So if we use our Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, then we get at the horizon, this is actually greater than zero, at least for most angles, except at the poles. So that means that this vector is actually what? Time-like, space-like, or null?
Space-like.
That's right, it's space-like. So it's time-like at large radii, but then by the time we hit the horizon, it's actually become space-like. So the obvious question is, at which point does it switch signs? Where does it become null? So to figure that out. We basically just wanted to determine where this is zero. So again, this is just the GTT. So that means that we want delta equals a squared sine squared theta. Or using the definition of delta, that gives us the following. Yeah, so if we just want to sketch that, you know, if we basically consider a face-on view, so we have our black hole, which is a sphere in these particular coordinates, R plus, and then our ergo region meets the horizon at the poles, and then extends out to R equals 2m at the equator. And if you consider sort of a top-down view of the solution in the equator, so here's the black hole spinning this way, then in the equator, this ergo region is just at R equals 2m. So we'll show later sort of how this ergo region gets its name. Ergo means work, and so actually this region is where you can extract energy from the black hole, as we'll see later. So this is also the region where observers have to rotate with the black hole in some sense. So to see the later fact, let's consider some time-like velocity UA. So that means when we contract it with itself, it should give us minus one. It's a four velocity, a time-like observer. So if we plug that in, we get all these diagonal terms. And then one sort of cross term. All right, so we can note that these are actually all going to be greater than or equal to zero. I mean, these are just squares, and we can look at these metric components and convince ourselves that they're all going to be positive as well. But if we're going to add up all these and get minus one, that means this quantity had better be negative. We can also note that this quantity GT phi is actually negative, and you know, since UT is just by definition derivative of the time with respect to proper time, you know, that better be positive if we're future pointing. If we put that together, that means that U phi, which is just the derivative of the azimuthal coordinate with respect to proper time for this observer, that had better be positive. So basically, we're not allowed to put this coordinate to zero and get a future pointing time like four velocity in the ergo region. Okay, so I think that's a good place to end here. Are there any other questions? Well, I will see you next class. And I guess there's the tutorial this afternoon.